I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Well, we all know it's a special day today. I have to wonder how many of our listeners are tuned in today rather than being out at some observation post, or soon will be. It all begins in just a couple of minutes. Don't forget our program will be online in the next day or two. On today's program, I'll offer a few thoughts about eclipses, physics, and metaphysics. We'll also be playing music that seems appropriate for such an event. Also on today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Diana Donlan, director of the Center for Food Safety. They discuss climate change and soil depletion. Later in the program, Movie Mole's Jan Hawken and Denise Morris review the film 2001 A Space Odyssey and include their thoughts on the solar eclipse. But we'll start, just for fun, with a song that claims and celebrates the cosmic significance for humans of the sun, moon, and stars, including such phenomena as the total eclipse of the sun. That's a great song, The Age of Aquarius by the Fifth Dimension. But with apologies to any astrologers tuned in today, the eclipse is an event totally lacking in any cosmic significance or meaning. While a rare event, it is an event totally explicable by natural science. It is neither a signifier of a new age of peace and love, nor dark omen of an impending apocalypse. Although it may come to be understood as such an omen, in that it can seem that the world is rushing into an apocalypse, the one totally of our own making. I'm referring, of course, especially to climate change, but also to the lunatic machinations of our current presidents, the causation versus correlation dilemma dramatically displayed. Well, that was kind of a downer, so let's play another song to lift our spirits. I looked for a song called There Goes the Sun, but had to settle for this.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. It
was time to bring things back to Earth now, and I mean that literally. As previously announced, here's Bill Resnick talking with Diana Donlan, director of the Center for Food Safety, on farming, soil depletion, and climate change.
Diana Donlan, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Diana Donlan directs the Food and Safety Program for the Center for Food Safety. Last year, Diana wrote for the center a report, Soil and Carbon, Soil Solutions to Climate Problems. Diana Donlan, it seems to me that the climate crisis and global warming, also the water crisis and running out of fresh, clean water around the world, and the food crisis, that much of the food we eat is near without nutrients, these deep problems get lots of attention, and they're pretty well known. But fast-worsening degradation of the planet's soil, it's talked about nearly exclusively in a few academic, scientific circles. Organic farming people talk about it. Yet all of these deep problems are linked. In fact, as your report points out, if we, humanity, can reverse soil degradation, then we will substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we will greatly reduce water scarcity, and we will grow much more nutritious food. Before discussing why that's true, first, I think we have to talk about soil degradation. It's happening all over the planet for the last 150 years, and it's now very, very quickly worsening. What's happening?
Well, thanks, Bill. Soil degradation has actually been going on for centuries, but we've accelerated it in the last 150 years. And humans have always known that there's some sort of relationship between soil fertility and, you know, food production, obviously. But it's only been in recent history that that understanding of soil productivity has been understood to be related to the amount of organic matter or carbon in the soil. And now that we realize that, we have a tremendous opportunity before us, because the amount of carbon on our planet is actually fixed. It's just a question, really, of distribution. So we know that there's way too much carbon in our atmosphere, and our atmosphere is obviously overwhelmed.
And it's warming as a result.
But I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that we're deficient in our soils, and that that carbon that's in the soil in a solid form is actually missing.
It's been taken out then in some ways. By what? Modern agriculture and deforestation and all of those things?
All those things contribute to it. So deforestation, erosion, clear cutting, the amount of what's called compaction, which is, you know, heavy machinery, like squishing the soil, paving over our soils. We really have treated our soils poorly. We don't appreciate them the same way maybe we appreciate water and some of our other natural resources. We treat soil like dirt. And the very general distinction between soil and dirt is that soil is a living system. And as a living system, it needs to be fed. If you think of soil as the skin of the earth, then you think, your skin needs to be covered and it needs to be protected. And what nature does is, when we leave nature to her own devices, you never see bare soil in nature. Every little side of the road, you know, ditch, nature will grow something. But we come along and we're constantly, you know, pulling up all the weeds, tearing down the trees, removing the vegetation, and exposing the soil microbial life to temperature extremes, extreme heat, extremes of cold, wind. All these things assault the life in the soil and make it very difficult for the soil to carry out its many functions.
Pesticides also take their toll, do they not, on microbes and insects and all of those processes that keep soil healthy?
Sure. You know, it's harder to say definitively which pesticides compromise the soil activity, but there's no question that things like Roundup and glyphosate harm soil microbial life. In fact, they're learning just now that can have an adverse impact at very low dosage. So when you kill those microorganisms that carry out all these functions, it just becomes harder for the soil to do things like hold water, which is one of its primary functions.
What about the ways in which carbon used to be just returned to the soil in natural processes like grasslands? Now we plow up those ancient grasslands or the forests, and the grain and the stalks and the corn cobs and everything, everything's taken away. Nothing is returns to the soil. That must also be one of the major sources of the degradation of soils.
Well, in the United States, the whole middle of the country was covered at one time by prairie, and that's where the great bison herds roamed. And we have destroyed about 97% of the American prairie, which was this diversified grassland ecosystem. We only have about 3% of it left. So imagine all that carbon that was released into the atmosphere as that process took place. And what happens is, when you take that carbon, and which was in a solid form in the soil, and release it so that it becomes a gas up in the atmosphere, and then there's nothing growing down below, it becomes very hard for the cycle to continue. So as I mentioned earlier, this is all a question of rebalancing the system. Carbon isn't inherently bad. It's just a question of where it is. So we need to get more of it back into the soil. Nature does this, as I mentioned, by having systems that are diverse. And we have a lot of monocultures in our industrial agriculture system. And that's not good for the soil life either, because it's like feeding a steady diet of the same thing all the time. The microorganisms living in the soil, they need a variety of food sources, not just corn and soy.
This is KBOO Radio. I'm Bill Resnick talking to Diana Donlan of the Center for Food Safety. She directs the Food and Climate Program for the center. Diana, we've talked about the soil degradation, and in fact, maybe we should say a word about the vast loss of soil in the Great Plains. Some of the soil used to be like 12 foot thick. Now it's like 3 or 4 foot thick. And in some areas of the country, all the soils have disappeared, like in Washington State and the Palouse. That's my understanding.
Well, globally, we've lost about 50 to 70% of the original carbon stock of cultivated soils. So it's very important to draw the distinction between the soils that we manage as humans and the soils that Mother Nature manages. So the soils that in wildlands are in balance, it's just the ones that we manage through our agricultural system. And we're realizing that tillage is very detrimental. So you hear a lot now, even in industrial agriculture, of a move towards no-till and increased cover cropping. And cover cropping is a great start, because if you've ever flown across the country and looked out the window and you see just vast expanses of bare dirt, that is oxidizing carbon. So even if you have an industrial system, but you are planting a crop to keep it covered, to keep the soil covered when you're not growing something that you're going to process, you're helping keep the soil alive, because otherwise it's like not feeding the soil for months at a time.
And you're allowing it to be blown away.
Exactly.
And eroded. If you get a storm and the water runs on this bare soil, it's in the rivers in no time.
Sure. And, you know, soil is really important for our water system. So what happens when you have this erosion and you have this compaction and all these different things, what's called effective rainfall is reduced. So when it rains, you really want that water to percolate back into the ground and recharge our aquifers. So there's a certain amount of water on our planet that you see in rivers and you see in lakes and so forth, but there's a lot more that's held in the soil as soil moisture. That water is filtered by the soil and it's held by the soil, and it has a cooling effect on our temperature. But when the soil structure is damaged by tillage, what's called the soil aggregates, which are little pockets of air, are compressed, and that doesn't allow the rain to infiltrate into the soil. So what happens when it does rain is the water sheets off, and that rain isn't effective. So it could rain, you know, a normal amount of rainfall, say that you're in an area where the average rainfall is 25 inches. You could get that 25 inches of rain per year, and not very many of those inches would be percolating back into the soil, because the soil structure is damaged. Most of that rain is sheeting off, causing flooding. So now we see with climate change, we see this kind of pendulum swinging wildly from not enough rain to too much rain. So you see flooding all the time. Well, a lot of that flooding has to do with the fact that we aren't slowing the water down. We aren't sinking it back into the ground. It's just coming, you know, faster and faster and going right back into the ocean with a lot of sediment.
With a lot of sediment, yeah. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick here talking to Diana Donlan of the Center for Food Safety. She directs the Food and Climate Program. We talked about how rebuilding soil carbon would greatly reduce the water crisis, keeping the water on the land and, in fact, percolating slowly and providing more for reservoirs all year round. We also talked about why nutrition would be better, because in healthy soil, the microbes themselves produce nutrients for the plants, which then go into the food. Tell us why rebuilding the soils would have a substantial effect on global warming.
Sure. Well, I'm sure that radio listeners have heard of this number 350. And there's a big organization, an international organization headed up by Bill McKibben called 350.org. And 350 is the number that climate scientists have told us that we should not exceed. And that's the amount of carbon that's in our atmosphere. Well, we have already exceeded that number. We're at over 400 parts per million, it's around 403 or something like
that. Of carbon dioxide.
Of carbon dioxide. Yeah. So even if miraculously somehow, some way, we stopped burning fossil fuels planet-wide tomorrow, we would still have this excess carbon in the atmosphere, and we have to draw that carbon down. Now, Mother Nature has just the most elegant and ingenious way to do that, and it's called photosynthesis. And photosynthesis is the process that actually removes carbon dioxide from the atmospheric circulation and draws it down into plant matter. And as much as 40% of what's photosynthesized by a plant goes through the roots into the soil. So the other 60% the plant is using to, you know, grow stems and leaves and so forth. But you'll remember from your elementary school science class that plants draw in CO2, they release that oxygen and we get to breathe it, and then they take that carbon and they use it. So this is how we can begin to draw down atmospheric CO2 and address global warming is by increasing photosynthetic activity on our planet. NASA is doing all these amazing satellite projections around the world, and they actually are able to show, Bill, this is really incredible, through their satellites, in the northern hemisphere, we have deciduous forests, and these are trees that leaf out in the spring. And you can actually see on a planetary basis the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go down when it's spring because there's so much photosynthetic activity taking place in the northern part of the planet. So our goal as a society, as a global society, should be we want the carbon inputs from photosynthesis to exceed the carbon losses. Okay? So if we can increase the amount of photosynthetic activity, and it sounds simplistic and it sounds unscientific, but if you think about how much we've destroyed on this planet in terms of, you know, not only rainforest but also temperate forest, deciduous forest, and add that up with the figure that I mentioned earlier, 97% of the prairie in this country being plowed under. That's a lot less photosynthetic activity going on this planet. So for people at home, every little thing you plant in your garden, it's important. You just want to have a diversity of plants in your garden. You want to keep your soil covered. You want to try and mimic nature to the best extent possible. And you want to have what are called perennials. And perennials are the plants that live year after year. And those are better at storing carbon because they have longer roots, so the carbon is pushed down further into the soil profile and it's more stable. And you don't have this, what happens with annuals, which a corn plant, for instance, would be most of our agriculture, our commodity agriculture is in annual production. You pull up the plant or the plant dies at the end of the season and those roots go up and that carbon goes back up into the atmosphere. So we want to encourage more perennial forms of agriculture because that is a more stable form of carbon.
There really are answers. We have trillions and trillions and trillions of little machines all over the planet that are feeding carbon, that are desperate for life. That is, these little seeds grow and they become plants, and these plants like to live like all life. And they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it into the ground. Trillions of them. And here we are spending huge amounts of money trying to develop clean coal. It's all absurd, it seems to me. What we have to do is use all those trillions of plants and add trillions more. That is, encourage their growth by various sorts of agricultural methods and reforestation.
We still need to reduce our fossil fuel emissions.
Right.
There's absolutely no question about it. And our campaign is not saying that we don't need to do that. We just need to add more tools to our toolbox. What we're saying is we need to do both. So we need to simultaneously stop putting so much CO2 and other gases up into the atmosphere and simultaneously draw down what is already up there in excess. So just to give you some sense of how large a reservoir soil is, the soil carbon pool right now, even with its deficit, is about 3 times larger than the atmospheric pool of carbon. So the atmosphere really can't hold as much carbon as the soil can.
That's incredible. It seems to me that we fully know what has to be done, that is, keep the carbon in the ground and restore our soils and do many other things, change our diets some, have transport that's electric and use renewable energy, all of these things. Restoring our soils, it seems to me, is extremely important. Let's talk about why is it so difficult to move towards regenerating and rebuilding our soils? What's going on?
Well, the people that started the climate movement, very emissions-focused, industrialized countries such as our own, and agriculture was really not considered. And, you know, we're trying to bring a systems approach to this problem and really, instead of seeing nature as our adversary, enlist nature's help, because nature has tremendous capacity for self-renewal. So if we start rebuilding soil carbon, which we now know how to do, we can start moving these systems in a way that's regenerative, that have all these co-benefits of increased water retention, of increased food security. Even if we didn't have a climate problem, we would still need to rebuild soil carbon for our food and water security. So this is just a no-lose proposition. It's a win-win-win proposition to rebuild soil carbon. But what that awareness has been missing, soil during the 20th century was looked at as a chemistry set, and we didn't really realize that it was this living system with all these symbiotic relationships between the roots and these specialized fungi like mycorrhizae and all these earthworms and nematodes and so on and so forth. We just looked at it as sort of a medium to add chemicals to and prop plants up. That awareness is changing. People are starting to study soil science now. We now have new tools, but it's really the last frontier. We know more about the stars overhead, I think it was Leonardo da Vinci who said this, than we do about the soil processes under our feet. So it's really a great time to be involved with soil science and have a new appreciation for soil. And I'd love to have your listeners look at a short film that we showed at the recent climate conference in Paris. They can go to YouTube. The name of the 4-minute film, which we had narrated by Michael Pollan, is called Soil Solutions to Climate Problems. We have it in Chinese, and we have it in French and Finnish, and we're getting it in more languages. But it really lays out this opportunity in a very short film, and we encourage people to watch it and share it with other people so that this soil carbon opportunity and avenue for hope is more widely known.
Diana Donlan, what we haven't talked about is the struggle on the land now for agroecology principles, and various kinds of agribusiness interests are loath to change. They've got a profit model and they just want to keep going. And particularly around the world, there are real predators who are destroying land very, very rapidly, like in the Amazon. It seems to me that becomes even more important to stop that and move towards regenerative and building soils. I'm afraid we don't have time, but maybe we can do that sometime soon. So I just want to thank you, Diana Donlan of the Center for Food Safety. Look up that YouTube short video. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night.
Tallis was the first known person to accurately predict an eclipse. Tallis was one of the Greek pre-Socratic philosophers of the 6th century BCE, some 200 years before Socrates. These pre-Socratic philosophers might more accurately be called the first natural scientists rather than philosophers, as they were the first to seek totally natural explanations for all earthly and heavenly phenomena. They were, in other words, the world's first materialists. They thought to explain all phenomena, all cause and effect, without reference to the gods or any other supernatural entities. Of course, they didn't get things quite right. They hypothesized that all things were composed of some combination of water, air, fire, and earth. But it was an awesome beginning to the materialist understanding of the universe that today is the universal premise of all scientific investigation. Unfortunately, this tradition of seeking to discover the nature of the cosmos in purely natural terms had declined by the time of Socrates and was obliterated entirely with the rise of Christianity as a state religion of the late Roman Empire. It wasn't until the time of Copernicus, over 1,000 years later, that the quest resumed in earnest to explore and understand the workings of the universe on naturalistic grounds. The eclipse is a fully understood natural event containing no mystical or cosmic meaning for either good or ill, period. In fact, the same goes for all celestial events, understood or not. The cosmos is indifferent to the human condition and our aspirations. Even say that is an anthropomorphism, as even indifference implies sentience, an attribute the cosmos is utterly lacking. The materialist position does not, however, rob humanity of a sense of awe as we ponder the cosmos and the nature of physical reality. Do you know that the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light? This does not invalidate Einstein's law that the speed of light is the universe's maximum speed limit. The universe is expanding, not traveling faster than that limit. Think of an uninflated balloon covered with black dots that represent galaxies. Then inflate the balloon and watch the dots fly apart. That's expansion. The day will come when the only stars that can be seen in the sky will be from our own Milky Way galaxy, as the other galaxies are receding too fast and are too far away for their light to ever reach us. If there are astronomers or any humans in this far distant time, hint, there won't be, they would have no way of knowing that anything lies beyond our own mid-sized galaxy. Also, serious consideration is being given to the possibility that we live in a multiverse rather than a singular universe, with mind-boggling implications. Perhaps even more awesome, astrophysicists calculate that our universe contains insufficient physical matter to prevent it from flying apart and self-destructing. To solve this dilemma, they have concluded that observable ordinary matter accounts for only 5% of the total mass energy of the universe, the balance consisting of unobservable dark matter and dark energy. They have no idea what these are, but they're pretty damn sure they're there. And last but not least is the awesome fact that animals such as we have evolved with the capacity to contemplate such things. Now Movie Moles Jan and Denise are here to review a film that also inspires awe. They joined the Sky Gazers this morning to comment on the solar eclipse and its different political and existential meanings for people. But the real interest this morning is to talk about Stanley Kubrick's 1968 classic film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, and how the film provides a way of thinking about the disturbing side of space exploration. The film is being screened in theaters throughout the country this week, many in connection with the solar eclipse, including at the Hollywood Theater. Their commentary is in two parts, and, like 2001, A Space Odyssey, there is a brief musical intermission.
Well, today here in Portland, Oregon, we're on the periphery of the path of the total solar eclipse. That sounds like a really mighty thing, but we're also, as we often are, marginalized by these events that capture the dominant culture. And there have been a lot of criticisms of eclipse mania and commercial exploitation of...
There are eclipse sales. Actually, special sales, eclipse.
No longer for your eclipse glasses. Fred Meyer sold out yesterday. So here at the station, we'll be slipping out here and there during the show today to see the sky darken and then lighten again. But it's also important to recognize these moments when everyone looks up and sees something in the skies that we all experience that makes us aware in a very dramatic way of how we're clinging to this planet hurling through space, and we are affected by forces in the cosmos that are immense, and there's a sense of awe and I think fear attached to that for many.
One thing that it brings to mind for me is the idea of an eclipse which obscures something for a period of time and then reveals that thing again. And so perhaps there's a new look at it. We could certainly use a new look right now at a lot of things.
And there are a number of festivals, the Symbiosis Festival in Madras, that's drawn a lot of activists trying to think of the eclipse as a backdrop to an inspirational, a kind of a heuristic, you might say, a way of reminding us that things can grow very dark and the possibility of transformation, even profound transformation, how we think about the world and our place in the world.
Right, and that is really what the old mole and many of us who dip into that socialism world believe, that transformation is really the key. That at some point, whether you've been in the dark by will or accident or what, however, you can come out of it.
Come up and moles in the ground, exactly. Coming to the surface.
Yeah. For me, it reveal in metaphor, perhaps, that there are these possibilities. As you said, gazing and looking up into the sky, and you know, I take for granted every day that I don't fall off the earth, just gravity. I will say that I was much more interested in baseball than I was in space as a child, but I accept certain things, and yet as a mole and a socialist, I don't accept other things that seem as common sense. And so for me, I think of the eclipse as this kind of possibility for folks to begin to not accept things as they are and to see
and
that.
For some, it does represent a hope, the kind of the perpetual dawn. And in thinking about the history of the use of the eclipse in film culture, which is also, of course, very visual and concerned with using imagery attached to visual culture, both of us were interested in 2001 Space Odyssey because it has shaped in many ways how we think about space, both in the way the film takes up kind of existential questions and the hubris, the arrogance of space exploration, but also raises questions, this film that came out in 1968 that are still very much with us around computer technology, fear of creating machines that come to overtake us in their powers, the role of the military in space, and the anxiety of these forms of exploration that change us profoundly, how technology in the course of human history can profoundly change who we are. And yet, on the other hand, the film draws on this idea that throughout human history, we've created weapons that become the means of our own destruction.
And that's a good starting point with 2001, because as the film opens, we see the dawn of man and we see our monolith for the first time, and then the conception on the part of the ape to see a bone as a tool. And that tool is first employed, although we see a cut to a live animal that appears to be prey, mostly we see that tool employed to beat another rival ape. And lurking in the backdrop of all of the space technology and all of the advanced technology is the use of that technology to control and intimidate and take power over others.
And when that film came out in 1968, there had been so much of the buildup to the moon landing, the race with Russia, with the Soviet Union, the Cold War Sputnik launch, where the Soviet Union seemed to have had an advance over the U.S., and that era when I grew up was fraught with the Cold War competition and the anxiety of both nuclear weapons, but also the scientific control over the world and space. So space became partly this kind of projected sphere that registered kind of ultimate domination. And at the same time, the Sputnik era was very much about competition around science, around technology. And it wasn't until the 80s that NASA and the space program became so militarized. Even in that era where 2001 Space Odyssey was being formulated, there was enormous competition around the space program. And it was very much, I think, a project that reflected some of the Cold War anxieties, you know, when the scientist first comes to meet with other scientists, he's meeting with these Soviet colleagues. It's a secret why he's going to the moon.
Not at liberty to talk about it.
Not because those who are on the station on the moon might suffer culture shock if they knew the secret of this monolith. And, you know, the plot is pretty loose in terms of this monolith that was there at the very beginning and transcends time, represents some kind of transcendent force, whether it's God or ultimate nature or an idea. It's a kind of unsubstantiated signifier.
A marker for the move then now forward from where you are. It is a sign,
but it's never
it's nothing, or it's just a square or a rectangle, whatever it is,
or a coffin
or but all we know is it makes a loud noise when it's there.
But I like that aspect of the film, that there are a lot of elements that are not really developed in the way Hollywood films do.
It's true, and the pace absolutely contrary to what the expectation is for action and drama. I think one example of that is the point at which Dave and Frank are the kind of crew on the ship to Jupiter, and they're the ones who engage with Hal, the Series 9000 computer who goes rogue. But Frank has gotten dislodged from his... I just saw it again last night, but I still can't remember how Frank got lost in space.
But he was going out to repair...
Oh, that's right.
Repair a malfunction the shuttle.
Oh, right. But that had to be a human malfunction. Couldn't have been Hal.
And so there was that interesting tension around human error, mm-hmm. and computer, the claim that computers are infallible.
Right, which is, another interesting
still a
piece of
topic.
This. Yeah, timely, But, you know, some of the drama is created around that slow pacing of Dave and his very concentrated effort to retrieve Frank from deep space. And watching that, my sense is I'm now disconnected from the story of life in space, where you have the corporate culture of space, you have the father talking to his daughter via teleprompter, whatever that thing
is. It's a Hilton Hotel and a Howard Johnson restaurant.
Right,
there
and,
in the space
and it's just
station.
Like, it's just life in space.
Uh-huh.
But
which suggests,
then,
too, that there's commercial interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a stewardess who comes to retrieve your pen that's floating around because there's no gravity. Everything is very slowly paced, but it really does create this idea that there could be life in space. And the whole era is filled with TV and film that explore space, outer limits, and Star Trek, all of these things
have
been happening.
The place with that idea of inhabiting space.
Right, the Jetsons cartoon. I mean, that you could live in space, but in fact, when we see Frank floating out and about in space, then that's a really disruptive moment. And that's where I come back to, you know, the idea of not just who we are, where we're going, etc., but how do we stay put on this planet at all?
Thank you.
part of what I enjoyed about 2001 Space Odyssey was that, unlike so many Hollywood films, including films about a crisis in space, some meteorite or threatening force being confronted in space, even in the vastness of space, this was a very kind of lonely movie, and there was something very solitary about it that was unsettling, but I think in a way that countered a kind of manic mastery that dominates so many Hollywood films. You see, as this astronaut is separated from the mothership, and there are a lot of these fetal images, including at the end of the film, that are themselves interesting about the human, and in this case, man's dependency on a mothership, a mother, and his vulnerability, and drifting off, and these small figures who become kind of lost in space and not retrieved. There's not a rescue mission here that succeeds. And in that sense, it counters a lot of the mastery imagery that still dominates a lot of the science fiction films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Alien comes up in at least one article I found, but it did strike me that Alien is sort of the antidote, in a way, to a certain genre of,
you mean the
of
three,
horror
there were three,
and space.
There were three Alien films.
Right, so we would be just talking about the original Alien, the first one, in which just the whole shine of living in space, of life in space, is kind of taken off. The film was made in 1979. It's not about a hope or an inquisition or an idea that we could land somewhere and discover something. It's just a more cynical, a more devious world out there. And of course, there's an alien that is also a perfect being in its own way. But that film is an interesting counter.
Also a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
Are you thinking in a different way?
Well, their computer system is Mother. So we have HAL 9000 and then we have Mother, but both Mother and their AI, you know, artificial intelligence embodied crew member, is programmed to make sure that the crew does the bidding of the company, which is often been written about as a kind of merger of military and corporation. You know, it occurred to me through this last viewing of the film that Alien was a very interesting counterpoint to a film that seemed actually hopeful in its interest in space, but also cautionary and critical of the possibility for it to become another grand capitalist project. So,
or a place of escape or retreat from a fouled earth.
Right.
That's another storyline.
Mm-hmm.
I was also interested in how Kubrick dealt with the hierarchy. I mean, there's a very rigid hierarchy, a military hierarchy on this spaceship. And of course, these missions are governed by a military hierarchy, a lot of military secrets. But the astronauts were not told why they were on this mission. And how the computer was, the supercomputer was the one who asked the questions. It was kind of funny. He said, "Dave, there's something about the mission that makes me uncomfortable. I feel like there's something I'm not understanding about the mission." And of course, it was a very fanciful representation of a computer that asked the questions. It's almost like how the computer was the unconscious of the astronauts, asking the questions they dare not, rebelling in ways they dare not.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting representation of this machine that is itself super intelligent, represents superhuman intelligence, but in that sense also questions. And there's this questioning of the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And the astronauts themselves can't really question what they're doing or why they're on this incredibly bleak journey.
There's nothing Hal can't do.
No, and it was, so in that sense, it's a very kind of paranoid film too. These machines, it's like the panoptical presence of a form of control and omniscience that you cannot escape, that they could not escape the eyes and ears of this computer. It was quite disturbing in that way.
It's disturbing and amazing and funny. It's a really incredible film.
Yeah, and the last part of it was the imagery was very much evoked a kind of acid trip also.
Right.
a period piece. A film of its times. It was clearly meant to be kind of an acid trip experience with all of these lights and colors and coming into another zone of awareness, another dimension. And then at the end, it's quite confusing, but at the end of the film, it really is about facing death alone, is one way of looking at it. This astronaut is alone in a room created for him by aliens. And it's kind of bleak, but what it could be read in many ways. One is about it could be read against the critical aspects of the film, or as the outcome of this kind of arrogance and hubris, that you die a very lonely death in a very distant place.
Right, and in the pursuit of all of these moon landings and space travel, lots of people have lost their lives. And I think about it and I think, are you kidding? I would never go into space. And I wouldn't bungee jump either, so...
It's dangerous enough looking at the sun in eclipse without protective eyewear.
God,
there's enough anxiety about that.
Capitalism gives me enough of a headache.
Kubrick's classic film from 1968, 2001 A Space Odyssey, is being screened in theaters around the country.
And the Hollywood Theater, they're featuring Kubrick for the month. 2001 will be shown again in 70mm. There'll be two screenings, so folks can look into that film and many of his other films at the Hollywood Theater in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
All right. This has been Denise Morris and Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Let's go out today with another song to celebrate the eclipse. It's a song whose title can actually be taken literally rather than metaphorically if addressed to the sun itself.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.